There's a, certainly a window in Asia that's open right now for gas from Alaska, but we're not sure how long that window's going to be open.
State officials turn their attention to North Slope Gas. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Begich proposes changes to Social Security.
This will create sustainability upwards to another 75 years to Social Security, which is the right way to solve this problem.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Start a second career. Earn a Master's of Arts and teaching degree from the University of Alaska Southeast, from home or on campus. Registration information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
If this legislative session was all about oil, the next one could be more focused on natural gas. The end goal is a pipeline capable of moving the massive supply of gas on the North Slope to market. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that the state is looking at the issue of getting a project online from multiple angles.
Joe Balash didn't get much rest after the legislature gaveled out. He didn't even have time to clean out his desk. As a deputy commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources, Balash had to fly straight to LNG 17, a conference that's billed as this year's biggest global gas event.
We went directly from Juneau down to Houston.
After spending the past few months as one of the key players on the governor's oil tax bill, he and the rest of that team immediately pivoted to natural gas policy.
We've now got some clarity on what the business is going to look like on the oil side, and now we and the producers can turn our attention to how gas fits into that.
The state is trying to advance a couple of major projects. Basically, one would be a moneymaker, like the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, but for gas. The other would be smaller and built to serve Alaska's own consumers with cheaper energy. And they're trying to move those forward from two fronts, the policy side and the design side. When it comes to policy, the state is trying to figure out whether it wants producers to pay them directly in money, or if it wants an actual cut of the gas itself. Right now, Alaska has the option of switching back and forth between the two every 90 days, which Balash says creates some uncertainty for companies. As for the design front, Governor Sean Parnell has said that he wants the companies involved in the project, TransCanada and the Big North Slope oil producers, to be at what's called the preliminary front-end engineering design stage this summer.
That's a lot of words to say actually doing the math and understanding what it's going to take to physically put together the pipe.
So far, the administration is still in talks to make that happen. But Balash says they're hoping companies start doing field work by June. Dan Sullivan is a commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and he says keeping momentum up on the project is important. The natural gas market is volatile. When the state first made financial commitments to develop a big gas line, the idea was to ship gas to the lower 48. With that market now glutted with cheaper energy, Sullivan says they want to send gas to countries like Japan and South Korea instead.
There's certainly a window in Asia that's open right now for gas from Alaska, but we're not sure how long that window's going to be open.
The Parnell administration has put a lot of effort into wooing Asian nations, with the governor even touring the Pacific Rim this fall to promote Alaska's resources. But Alaska isn't the only place that's courting that market. Larry Pursley handles pipeline issues for the federal government, and he follows the economics of energy closely. He says that if the state wants to get enough buy-in from those countries to go ahead with a big pipeline, it's going to need to offer competitive rates.
There's no question in the decades ahead, 2020s, 2030s, 2040s, the world is going to need more natural gas than it uses today. And a lot of the old contracts that were written in the 90s to supply Asia will be expiring. So that's another potential to go in there. But it's going to come down to price. Alaska gas is not going to command any higher price in the market than any any other molecules. It all burns the same.
As far as whether all of this work from the state will amount to a pipeline anytime soon, Persily says that there would be one big indicator that the North Slope producers are getting serious. That's if they start having official talks with the administration about gas line development by the end of this year. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Senator Mark Begich plans to introduce two bills related to Social Security by next Monday. Begich met with leaders of Alaska organizations today in Anchorage to gauge their concerns and to announce his plan. The senator says the conversation on Social Security will come before Congress by June, and now is the time to make changes that will strengthen Social Security benefits, not curtail them.
I think there's a lot of interest that's been generated over the last couple of years, and now we're seeing people really talking more about it. And as we move to issues of the budget and a long-term budget plan for the federal government, Social Security is part of the equation and figuring this out and solving this.
Begich plans to introduce the Protecting and Preserving Social Security Act and the Social Security Fairness Act of 2013 when he returns to Washington, D.C. next week. He says his plan has 3 points. The Protecting and Preserving Social Security Act would remove a cap on high-income contributions. The cap is now at $113,700. Removing the cap would make high-income earners pay into Social Security just like everyone else, he says.
Right now, the Social Security tax is capped. So if you make more than $113,000, you're not paying any more into it after that point. And what we want to do is match it like Medicare, so everyone pays in and everyone does receive a benefit. It just means the more you make, you may not get as much of a benefit, but you'll still pay into it, and it's an earned benefit. This will create sustainability upwards to another 75 years to Social Security, which is the right way to solve this problem.
The second part of that bill would revise how Social Security payments are adjusted to better reflect how America's seniors spend their income. Currently, payments are based on a consumer price index model that does not accurately reflect higher costs seniors pay for medications, for example. The bill would create a CPIE for elders. The Social Security Fairness Act would remove penalties that are now placed on retirees who worked more than one job, paid into Social Security, but then retired under a different retirement system. Under current law, they are denied their Social Security benefits. Many government workers and some teachers in Alaska fall into that category, workers like Janae Sears.
When I retired 4 years ago on June 1st, with 43 years, I lost 45% of my base pay right then and there. And that's why I'm so adamant about fairness.
She says she draws a civil service retirement system pension and is not allowed her full Social Security benefits because of the present government pension offset program. The southern tanner crab stock is no longer considered overfished. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration considers the Bering Sea Aleutian Island stock rebuilt.
The southern tanner crab, or bairdeye, has been downgraded in NOAA's annual report to Congress. In 2011, the crab was listed as overfished. Now the federal government says the stock is safe. Emily Menashis is a deputy director in the Office of Sustainable Fisheries. She says overfishing means the harvest rate is too high for a population. There's another distinction, overfished. That's when a fish population is too low. In the case of the tanner, it's now considered rebuilt.
Which means that a previously overfished stock has increased to its target population level.
That's good news, says Gretchen Harrington. She works on environmental protection for NOAA in Anchorage. Harrington says the change comes from a couple of factors, including highly fluctuating populations and just how the federal government measures the volume of the stock. The tanner crab population was considered rebuilt in 2007 as well. It's unclear whether the state will open a tanner crab season this year.
While we might not call it overfished, the state might decide not to open the fishery for a number of other reasons.
Those include the total amount of female tanner crab. There was no tanner crab season last year. The season runs during the fall and winter. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, preparing for the commission ceremony of the USS Anchorage.
We are a taxi service. We take Marines all over the world. Be ready at a moment's notice whenever the president calls upon us. That's our primary mission.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
It's a busy week for energy issues in Alaska. Today, the Business of Clean Energy Conference opens at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. It follows the Rural Energy Conference that wrapped up yesterday at the Sheraton Hotel and involves some of the same participants, rural utility managers looking for ways to save on power generation costs through renewable energy sources and conservation. This second conference is sponsored by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, and concentrates on the nuts and bolts of what works and who is making it work. Whether it's new technology, improving designs of older technology, or the most effective cost saving of all, simply using less energy. REAP Executive Director Chris Rose points to the Home Weatherization and Home Energy Rebate programs run by the state of Alaska as big success stories, now saving Alaska homeowners some $37 million per year.
The average savings has been about 30% on people's heating bills. 28,000 homeowners have gone through that. But that only amounts to about 11% of the entire state's population, so we have a long way to go.
This will be the fifth annual Business of Clean Energy Conference. It will be looking at a wide range of energy technologies and how they are being used in Alaska and elsewhere, with an eye toward whether they fit here in a business sense. The USS Anchorage arrived in its namesake city yesterday. Several events are taking place leading up to a commissioning ceremony for the ship on Saturday. KSKA's Daisha Eaton took a tour of the ship and has this story.
If you look down toward the port from downtown Anchorage this week, you may notice a big gray ship. That's the USS Anchorage, a new Navy transport vessel named in honor of Alaska's largest city. It's here for a commissioning ceremony on Saturday. But between now and then, the ship is open to the public for tours. Chief Petty Officer Ryan Astell from California is leading tours this week. He says the ship's main mission is transporting troops and equipment. Or as he put it, they're a taxi service for the Marines.
Essentially, that's what we are. Joking, but we are a taxi service. We take Marines all over the world. Be ready at a moment's notice whenever the president calls upon us. That's our primary mission.
There are 360 sailors on board and three Marines, but the ship can carry between 800 and 1,000. It's nearly 700 feet long and 10 stories high. It was constructed in Avondale, Louisiana, at a price of $1.3 billion. The vessel is based in San Diego, California. It took 9 days to get to Anchorage. The ship has self-defense systems, anti-air missile launchers, and large deckside machine guns. There are only 7 of the San Antonio-class amphibious transport dock ships in the U.S. Astell says the ship is unique because of its ability to sink, allowing smaller ships to dock within the ship. San Diego-based Chief Mass Communications Specialist Holly Gray is also leading tours of the ship. She says the ship has a flight deck and can land and refuel rotary aircraft such as helicopters.
Our flight deck area here, we actually have 2 main landing spots and 4 additional auxiliary spots. We don't have aircraft permanently assigned to the ship, but we have the capability to land any rotary aircraft in the Navy and Marine Corps fleet, because to include the MV-22 Osprey. We actually have one on deck for a demonstration, as well as one of the other smaller helicopters.
Beneath the ship's main deck is the equivalent of a small city, a hangar bay, a full hospital, crew mess, and living quarters. Down below, Gray points out where Marines and sailors sleep. Quarters resemble a train car with sit-up racks or shallow bunk beds stacked 3 high on either side of a narrow hallway.
You have a tray to place a book for reading material, iPad, things like that, a little tray for your alarm clock, personal light, and outlet. Typically, most of these, it's 3 people per side of the racks.
They're stacked 3 high.
They are stacked 3 high in this particular configuration.
All the way up in the bridge, you're around 100 feet above the water, and it takes a team to drive the ship.
There's a whole team of watchstanders up here working together to make sure we take this very large ship, 684 feet long, without breaks and navigate it through the water safely.
But back on a lower deck, the thing that makes the vessel stand out is that well deck. It just looks like a regular deck, but with a very high ceiling.
This is what makes the ship an amphibious transport dock, because this area here actually has the capability to what we call ballast or deballast, either flood tanks on the inside of the bulkheads, either fill them with salt water or force air into them to be able to raise and lower the aft end of the ship, so that we can actually sink the back end of the ship to create a boat dock, essentially, and flood this area with water so that if we need to recover small boats, launch craft, things like that, they have a ramp and a boat dock to be able to do that.
In the well deck at the moment is a special hovercraft that can carry cargo, vehicles, and marines at high speeds to shore. The ship is something to be seen, but Chief Petty Officer Astle says it's the people who run it that make it special.
The ship is a big piece of steel. The crew is what brings the ship to life, and we have the best crew on this ship, hopefully representing Anchorage the best we can.
Astle and Gray are leading tours through Friday. The USS Anchorage's visit is the first official event leading up to the Anchorage Centennial. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaskan pilot Art Mortvedt is due back in Fairbanks any day now from his solo flight to the North Pole. It was the second leg of a mission to realize his long-held dream of flying a single-engine aircraft to both the North and South Poles. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
We caught up with Art Mortvedt on Tuesday afternoon somewhere in the skies over Nunavut in far northern Canada. In a sometimes spotty satellite phone connection, Mortvedt reported that he's headed west in his sturdy Cessna 185, as weather allows, on his way home after reaching the North Pole 3.5 weeks ago.
But I'm just cruising along here on 4,000 feet in between the village of Flucktuck and Great Bear Lake. And headed into the Northwest Territories and then into the Yukon and then back to Alaska.
Mortvedt says he was glad to see the fringes of boreal forest appear not long after he left the village of Kugluktuk. He says the scroungy black spruce had never looked so beautiful after weeks of seeing nothing but an endless expanse of snow and ice stretching from horizon to horizon pretty much ever since he left Fairbanks on March 20th. Mortvedt is no stranger to flying in remote regions. He's a longtime Alaskan bush pilot who's logged some 5,000 hours of flight around the bush and elsewhere, and who, along with his wife Damaris, divides his time between homes in Manly Hot Springs and a hunting lodge near Kobuk in northwestern Alaska. He's spent the better part of 6 seasons providing logistical support for scientific studies of the North Polar ice pack, and he's flown in more than 20 expeditions to Antarctica. Mortvedt first flew the modified Cessna 185 during one of those expeditions, and he liked the way it handled. He says after flying a French scientist to a research station at the South Pole, he got an idea.
When I arrived at the South Pole, I thought, well, it would be fun to fly the same airplane to the North Pole someday.
That was back in November 1999. He bought the 185, modified it further still for cold weather flying, painted it bright orange, and dubbed it the Polar Pumpkin. Mortvedt set out in 2011 and 2012 to fly the Polar Pumpkin to the North Pole, but was turned back both times by bad weather. He's run into his fair share of rough weather on this trip, too, but he took his time, waited out the storms, and on April 6th, he realized his long-held dream.
And just completed my mission of taking this airplane to both poles of the world.
Mortvedt says the ice around the pole itself was buckled and unstable and unsuitable to risk a landing, so he flew around the pole and set down nearby at Russian ice station Barneo, where he spent a few days waiting for a break in the weather to begin the journey home. Now that he's on his way, his wife Damaris says she can breathe a bit easier. She says she's been following his journey at home at Manly Hot Springs with an online satellite-aided tracker system, and that they've talked as often as conditions allow via sat phone. But Damaris says it was tough when they couldn't connect, and she knew he was probably socked in somewhere out there.
It is a little stressful in those areas where there is so little communication and such hostile weather, for sure.
Mortvedt obviously is something of an adventurer. He's a member of the Explorers Club of New York, and he's a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society of London. But his mission was more than just a flight of fancy. Mortvedt says he set out to demonstrate the practicality of using a single-engine aircraft for polar research, and in the process to conduct research himself, making observations on the impact of climate change on the polar ice cap and collecting air samples for a UAF Geophysical Institute experiment on the extent of black carbon particles in the Arctic generated by human-caused fires. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
An Alaska-based soldier from South Carolina will serve nearly 12 years in a military prison and be dishonorably discharged after killing a fellow soldier on Christmas morning. Specialist Marshall D. Drake, Jr. of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, was sentenced today after being convicted in a general court-martial of involuntary manslaughter. The 23-year-old Drake was accused of shooting Private Grant W. Wise of Fairport, New York, in Drake's barracks room on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. A witness at the court-martial said Drake and Wise continued their Christmas Eve drinking into the early morning hours when the shooting occurred. It looks like there won't be a Chinook subsistence fishery on the Stikine River this year. Officials this week closed the annual opening scheduled for May 15th to June 20th. The Stikine is a transboundary river flowing from British Columbia to the ocean near Wrangell and Petersburg. Bob Dalrymple of the Wrangell Ranger Station District says the numbers are below what's required under the Pacific Salmon Treaty between the U.S. and Canada.
That treaty stipulates that a directed Chinook salmon subsistence fishery can't be harvested if the preseason estimate is less than 28,100 Chinooks.
The estimate is about 3,600 fish, or 20% below that level. Dalrymple can authorize subsistence fishing during the season if the estimate exceeds 24,500 Chinooks. He's given that authority by the Federal Subsistence Board, but he says another Stikine fishery is more important.
In reality, the Chinook salmon is not the targeted species for subsistence on the Stikine. It's more of an incidental catch. The numbers are fairly low. The stronger fishery, the more targeted fishery is for sockeye.
The Chinook closure does not affect later Stikine subsistence fisheries. The sockeye season runs June 21st through July. A coho season follows from August through October. A play about the life of Athabascan elder Sidney Huntington of Galena takes back to the stage tonight in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's the start of an interior tour for The Winter Bear.
The Winter Bear was written by former Alaska State Writer Laureate Anne Hanley of Fairbanks.
It began in 2007 when some young men in Fairbanks were fed up with all the suicides of their peers and decided to do something about it. And they started having dances and doing other things, and one of them got the idea of doing a play.
Hanley says The Winter Bear has been performed locally and in Anchorage and Galena over the last 5 years. But following this week's shows in Fairbanks, the play begins an interior tour that includes showings in Tok, Tanacross, Northway, Mentasta Lake, Copper Center, and Glen Allen. The rural community residents will get to see a play Hanley says has evolved with input from Sydney Huntington.
I was able to spend some time with Sydney Huntington, and he did open up to me about the suicide of three of his sons and how that was still affecting him even today. And he said that he thought it was time to stop being silent about this issue and to talk about it. So I took that as my charge to incorporate that issue in the play.
The Winter Bear portrays painful realities and a message of hope through the relationship of an elder Huntington and a young man, with supporting characters including a raven and other animals. It's carried out by Alaska Native actors, including Athabascan Brian Westcott, who plays Sydney Huntington.
Which is a great honor, and is also intimidating because he is a legend, a very revered figure in our community. And I have to give a big credit to Sydney. There are some parts of this that are not flattering to him, but he's told the company if this will help save one person's life, it's worth it.
Westcott says the Winter Bear draws on a feeling of deep grief common to all Native people.
What this play allows all of us in the production to do is to tap into that in a constructive way, in a way that has a purpose and can lead to something, that we're not just passive victims of this terrible legacy, but we can start to get ownership of it. We can do what Sydney did, which is stand up, own up to it all, and move forward.
The rural community performances of The Winter Bear are being coupled with acting workshops in schools and community discussions about suicide and other issues in the play. The project has support from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the Tanana Chiefs Conference. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bear that attacked a man without provocation on Sunday on a Kasiloff beach was not rabid. Soldotna wildlife biologist Jeff Selinger sent in the grizzly's head for testing because the animal had attacked a telephone pole and a moving pickup before bruising 48-year-old Toby Burke as he birdwatched. Alaska State Troopers killed the bear. Department of Fish and Game veterinarian Kimberly Beckman in a press release says poor vision may have made the bear aggressive. The 20-year-old sow was blind in her right eye from an old injury. The cornea of her left eye was clouded. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership positions across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.